Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, healthcare, climate change, the cost of college, marijuana, and more. DFL Senator Tina Smith is in the studio. We have a lot to cover. And since I'm starting our discussion with healthcare policy, I invite your initial calls about that. What are you concerned about when it comes to the way you pay for healthcare, the way you access it when you or your family need it? What should Senator Smith know about your experience? So we're starting with healthcare policy this morning, and I'm inviting your experiences and your questions about it. What are you concerned about when it comes to accessing healthcare? What are you concerned about when it comes for paying for it? And what should Senator Tina Smith know about your experience? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. You can reach us on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Senator Smith, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie. It's wonderful to be with you.
Tomorrow, many of the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president are going to appear on a debate stage in Ohio. The subject of Medicare for All is sure to come up the way Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have described this. You would have to give up your employer-sponsored and provided health care to come in under a government-administered plan. Starts out expensive. They say it eventually ends up paying for itself, and it saves money for individual Americans. Do you think that that is where American health care should be headed?
I am not a supporter of Medicare for all. You know, if we were to be starting from a blank board and designing our health system from scratch, I don't think there's any way that we would design it the way it is right now. It's so complicated, so challenging. So many different ways that healthcare gets paid for and so many different incentives that don't support people being healthy rather than paying for people when they're sick. So, but having said that, I wouldn't go to Medicare for All. What I hear when I'm out talking to Minnesotans is, help me figure out how to make my health insurance cheaper. Help me make sure that I've got access to good health insurance. So where I start from is, first of all, we shouldn't be undermining the basic protections in the Affordable Care Act, right? That the Affordable Care Act helped make sure that people had insurance. If we got rid of the Affordable Care Act, like the Trump administration wants to do, 21 million Americans would lose their health insurance. Let's start with that. But then we've got to go farther than that. We've got to get a handle on lowering prescription drug costs. I think we need to take a look at allowing Medicare to negotiate for lower drug prices. That'll help a lot. I've got bills to help lower drug prices. And then we need to, there's so many things to talk about here. Expanding access to mental health care, maternity and obstetrics care in rural areas. There's many, many things that we can do right now.
Let me ask you about a lot to follow up on there.
Right.
Do you think that we, though, with as invested as you are in the ACA, do you think we are headed to a marketplace where we will detach health care coverage from employer-sponsored and from the jobs that we do, from employer-sponsored healthcare? Is that where we should go? Is that where you think we are headed?
I can't even say right now that that is where we're headed. You know, in Minnesota and many states around the country, a significant percentage of people are getting their healthcare from their employers. Now, not everybody loves their healthcare, and that healthcare is going up. But that is sort of the way our system is set up right now. I think what I support, though, is the idea of allowing people to buy into, opt into Medicare expanding access to healthcare more generally. But I don't think that people should be forced into that kind of a system.
Okay, so opting in, is that a version of the public option that you would support?
It would be a public option for health, for buying into Medicare. And very important, though, it's the key word is option. if you have your health care, a lot of people receive their health care through their employer. A lot of union members receive their health care through their employer, and they like the health care that they get. They like the way it works. I don't think that those folks should be forced into something that they don't want to do.
Let me ask, do they like their doctors and not really like their providers? I mean, when you say they like health care, we're going to hear from a number of listeners this morning who have a lot of beefs about their health care.
Totally. Yeah.
So what is it that, when you're talking to constituents about this, that they really like about it?
Well, they when people are happy with the health care that they get, and you're absolutely right, not everybody is happy with it. When they are happy with it, they're happy with it because they like the doctors that they have. They feel good about the networks, the provider networks that they're a part of. They feel like their health care is going to be there for them when they need it. And if they are getting that kind of a situation through their union membership or through their employer, then they don't really want to mess with it. But, I mean, let's be honest and real about this. There are a lot of people like the farmers that I talked to in rural Minnesota who were paying over $30,000 a year for health care premiums and deductibles. And that is one of the biggest economic factors in their life as they're trying to figure out how to make farming work, for example.
I wanted to talk deductibles, and we actually have a call, I think, on this to Jill in Woodbury. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
What do you want to say?
What I hate about my health care, and this has been true, I think, since around 2002 or 2003, is that I make decisions for myself and my family based on where I'm at in terms of my deductible. Last New Year's Eve, I slipped and fell on the ice, and I know I had a mild concussion. And I didn't go to the doctor because it was December 31st, and I wasn't going to start the new year with however many thousands of dollars, an MRI or a CAT scan or whatever other kind of services I might have needed. And I think that that is a rotten way of taking care of ourselves. I think it's the healthcare system is broken, and we use and access medical services that we paid for.
Okay.
That's right.
Jill, I think we have the essence of that, but for listeners who couldn't catch it, Jill describes falling on the ice. It was the end of the year. She knew she had a mild concussion. She didn't want to use her deductible, basically. She didn't want to have to pay for that. So she didn't end up going to the doctor. Senator, we hear this all the time when we talk about deductibles and health care policy. What is the solution?
Well, first of all, that is just exactly how we don't want the system to work, right? We don't want somebody to be foregoing health care because they're trying to avoid the out-of-pocket costs. And so, you know, what I think we ought to be doing about this is making sure that if you know, the way health insurance works is if you have more people in bigger pools, then the overall cost of a concussion or a hip replacement or somebody has COPD gets spread out over a large pool.
These are the risk pools, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. They get spread out over a large pool of people, and then the overall cost it doesn't fall so disproportionately on somebody who's trying to avoid a deductible at the end of the year. Now, I think one of the things that we have accomplished over the last several years with the improvements under the Affordable Care Act, and don't get me wrong, it is far from perfect, is to stop this expansion of the so-called junk plans, which essentially cover you unless you're sick. you have the insurance, but you don't have any help if you actually get sick.
You pay premiums, you don't really have a lot of coverage.
Exactly. Yeah. You pay premiums, but you don't really have a lot of coverage. And I don't know exactly what Jill's situation is here, but I think that's the kind of thing that we really need to crack down
on
here.
But I'm not sure we zeroed in on the deductible issue here. I mean, this is something that, you are correct about the ACA, covered many more Americans. But many more Americans ended up buying into or having health care that they hesitate to use because it's so much money on the front end. And this is something that the health plans seem to have steadily ratcheted up more and more of the burden on Americans, even though we're already paying premiums for our health insurance.
Yeah.
What specifically is out there? What do you support? What kinds of ideas do you have about addressing this deductible problem?
Well, what I support is allowing people, moving towards a place where people can buy into Medicare, which I think will help to lower deductibles. I also think that we need to address the kind of get ahead of a lot of our healthcare costs. Now, this isn't specifically related to Jill's situation with falling and having a concussion, but, you know, we don't invest nearly enough in preventative care, and that has a significant impact on overall costs. You know, overall healthcare costs in this country are rising, I think, in the last year at around 9.5%, but people's incomes have only gone up around 2%. So the rising cost of healthcare is what is driving these deductibles, and that's what we have to get a handle on. Let me just mention one thing that I think is an example of what we can be doing. Right now, what we do is we reimburse healthcare expenses in a very siloed way. Mm-hmm. Here's for the reimbursement for the anesthesiologist. Here's for the emergency room. Here's for the
everybody comes
exactly.
with their bill.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. There's reforms that are being considered that would say we ought to bundle those payments. We ought to compensate healthcare providers based on the total cost of care and based on the quality of care that people get. That, I think, would have a big impact on overall cost of care, and that's going to help to lower deductibles, which is what Jill is faced with and so many others.
The providers are not universally thrilled about this, right?
They're not universally thrilled about it, but I think our job is not to make the providers universally thrilled. Our job is to figure out how to get a handle on the cost of health care. And we know that in this country, we pay so much more for our health care than most other places in the world. And one of the reasons is because of the way we reimburse for the cost of health care.
Call here from Julie in Minneapolis. Hi, Julie. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi.
Hi. You're on with the senator.
Yeah, great. So I wanted to say that I have to pay a premium and the deductible, and I don't even use medical. And so unless it's a catastrophic event, I am not using the conventional medical system, and so then additionally, I put out probably $300 to $400 a month in my alternative care. So I've got the standard premium of about $500. I got roughly a $10,000 deductible that I wouldn't use unless I'm, you know, in an accident. So I don't see options for people like myself, and I think there's a growing population that doesn't use conventional medicine.
What do you think, Senator?
Well, if what I'm understanding Julie is saying, there are a whole series of things that we could be reimbursing for that we aren't. So let's talk for a minute, for example, about people who might have, I don't know if this is the situation here, but people who might have problems with chronic pain. Now, traditionally, the healthcare system has compensated chronic pain treatment that is, opioids, and look where that got us. Rather than the kind of alternative treatments for chronic pain, like meditation, like exercise, like even acupuncture. I think that's the kind of thing that we need to be looking at and improving. I was listening on the radio today about a person. We all know that if we exercise more, that's one of the best kinds of physical therapy that we could do. And mm-hmm. they were talking about this system where they had, you might have a set of a pill box that has, I need to take 5 pills on Monday and 3 pills on Tuesday, and it's all in the pill box. Well, what they designed is a system that would say, here's your exercise pill.
Clever.
For Monday. Yeah. To remind us that there are a lot of things that we can do that don't require pharmaceuticals or even a doctor's visit to help us stay healthy.
Call here from Keith in Little Falls. Hi, Keith.
Hi. So long as new drugs and technologies are under patent, companies are allowed to charge whatever they want. And I don't think Congress can enforce any price gouging laws as long as they are under patent. In order to create an incentive for new drugs and technologies, we allow that patent to take effect. If we want to have new drugs that help us and new technologies to help us, that's what's driving the cost of a lot of the cost of healthcare. If we subsidize research and development for a lot of these companies, it might drive down the cost. But then there would be so many companies out there that have so many fickle research and development processes going on that it would not have any fruition.
Yeah, Keith, you've put your finger on something. There is, I know there's legislation that has been debated in the Senate. I think Senator Klobuchar is one of the co-sponsors on this. Where is that? This is to address the patent situation. What do you understand that it actually says here, Senator Smith, and where's it going?
Well, so the very first bill that I introduced in the United States Senate when I came to the Senate last year was a bill to crack down on this practice of name brand drug companies paying the generic drug companies to stay off the market. It's called pay for delay, and it's just wrong. And it allows those name brand drug companies to reap the benefits of their patent protection. They're essentially their monopoly power for longer by paying the generic drugs to stay off. There are other examples. I think that's wrong. We need to get rid of that. There are other examples of ways in which we allow long-term patents on drugs to stay on longer than they would normally, which is about 7 years. For example, we allow drug companies to make marginal changes to their formulation that doesn't have any impact on the efficacy of the drug, and then they can extend their patent. Like in one case, they added a little bit of salt. Doesn't have any impact.
So they change the compound just enough
to make it be different, and then they extend the patent. I'm author of a bill that would do away with that. But I want to bring up something that our caller just raised, which is one of the rationales for these patents is that these companies spent significant resources to do the innovation that comes up with the new drugs that help to keep us all healthy and get some of us, you know, get us.
Yeah, and I think Keith was acknowledging
and
that.
And I think that, and that is important. But we remember the fundamental research that goes into many, many drugs that are on the market right now was already paid by the taxpayer through big grants, through the National Institutes of Health, through public research institutions like the University of Minnesota. So we are already paying for the fundamental research that contributes to these drugs. We can have both. We can have innovation and drug prices that aren't many times higher in the United States than they are just across the border in
Canada. One of the things you said right at the beginning of our conversation was trying to have negotiation on drug prices. This is one of the few westernized healthcare system countries in the world where we don't do that. And I think it puzzles Americans as to why there's such a barrier to pushing this kind of legislation. Give us some insight. What happens that members of Congress decide it is not in their interest to support legislation that would allow negotiation on drug prices?
Well, the first point here is that we already allow, for example, the Veterans Administration to negotiate with drug companies for lower drug prices. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the most kind of American and capitalist of ideas, that you have two parties that negotiate with one another to come up with the best price, rather than what we have with Medicare, which is the drug companies say this is how much it's going to cost. And we take that price, which is really extraordinary. Now, why is that, you ask? Why would we be doing it that way? I think you have to look at the power of these big pharmaceutical companies in Washington, the amount of money that they spend on lobbyists and on lobbying members of Congress. And I think that it's impossible to look at this situation and say that that doesn't have a big impact. Every morning when I read the Politico playbook, there, and everybody knows that every member of Congress pretty much reads that to see what's happening during the day. And every morning there's a big piece right there that says basically why Nancy Pelosi's drug cost containment proposal is socialized medicine. Now, who pays for that? The pharmaceutical companies pay for that, trying to influence me every day. Now, it doesn't get to me. Obviously, I'm not their friend, but that's the problem.
So this is really, I mean, what you're saying here is even colleagues, some of them Democrats, some of them Republicans, will not move on this legislation because it endangers the financial contributions that they get from the industry. Is it as simple as that?
I believe that it is fundamentally about not being willing to stand up to these big drug companies. And I also think that there are Republicans and Democrats, you know, this is, and it should be, a bipartisan issue, how we can lower prescription drug costs for all of our constituents. And what I believe that if we were to bring something, it's vastly popular amongst Americans. If you ask Americans whether they think that we should be able to...
This is what's so infuriating about it.
It
goes on and on. Everybody talks about it and nobody does anything about it.
That's right. Well, we ought to be able to... I bet you, Carrie, that if we brought that bill up onto the floor of the Senate, that it would pass. But the question is, will Mitch McConnell allow it to come up onto the floor of the Senate? And the answer right now is no.
Senator Tina Smith is in the studio with us. She has to leave at about 10 to 10. So we are cramming in as many questions as we can get. And we've started out on health care because again and again, this is an issue that comes up in top concerns for Americans and for Senator Smith's constituents as well. By the way, I know you were out in Western Minnesota. You were doing some town halls. What did you hear when it comes to health care?
I have been doing a lot of work in what we can do to keep and expand access to health care in rural areas. You know, the challenges that rural hospitals face is really, really quite significant. Mm-hmm. And I had some great conversations, including with a rural hospital network in Ortonville, Minnesota, right up against the South Dakota border, about the work that they're doing to keep providers there, to recruit healthcare providers into communities. I have a bill that I'm working on with Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska, to expand access to maternity care and obstetrics care in rural areas. So I was asking them what they liked about that bill, how I could improve it.
And so expanding that, what, giving grants or something to some of these communities to recruit people? Or
so there are, as you may know, many, many counties in Minnesota that are rural counties are losing access to maternity care. We've seen so many stories about this. So we are trying to figure out how we can get to the bottom of that. And one of the key issues that we have is this challenge to recruit obstetricians mm-hmm. or GPs with an obstetrics specialty into communities. So what is that? How do we do that? A lot of that can be solved with loan forgiveness. That's a very helpful thing because, you know, if you're going to go
practice. To the individual doctor.
Yeah. If you're going to go practice in Ortonville, Minnesota as an obstetrician, you're probably not going to make as much money as you're not going to be able to pay off the hundreds of thousands of school debt that you might have as quickly as if you worked in, the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. A second thing is how can we expand access to telehealth? Help hospitals set up telehealth systems so that moms can get access to maternity care without necessarily having to travel all the time, all the way, if they're traveling 45 minutes or an hour. So there's some good ideas there for how we can expand access.
A call here from Jeff in Minneapolis. Hi, Jeff. I really appreciate you waiting. I know it's been a while.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I'm a 65-year-old Minnesotan, and I've been on Minnesota Care for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And I recently transitioned to Medicare and had more than one advisor and counselor and salesperson say to me that they usually are congratulating people when they transition to Medicare because their coverage is going to be so much better than the private coverage they've had. But with people transitioning from Minnesota Care, they're not celebrating it because the coverage won't be as good. And so I'm wondering why every Minnesota politician concerned about health care is not talking about Minnesota Care as a model for the nation of a universal coverage, cost controlling.
Okay.
I've been through, a stroke, back surgery, some pretty costly things, and Minnesota Care has kind of literally saved my life.
All right,
so I'm
Jeff.
Wondering why Minnesota.
I think we have the essence of that,
that's
Senator.
That's great. Well, Minnesota is unique in the strength of our Minnesota Care program. And, you know, when I was lieutenant governor, I was advocating for the state version of an opt-in to Medicare by saying, let's let people opt into Minnesota Care. Minnesota Care is not available if you are, it's tagged to people who's
income-based.
Income-based. But our theory was, let people opt in, they can pay their own way, and you get all of the benefits of Minnesota Care. And, you know, I've got on this idea when I was, again, talking to a farmer in rural Minnesota, and he said, you know, the guys who live, the family that lives down the road from me, they make a little bit less than we do. So they have the opportunity to be in Minnesota Care because I'm making a little bit more. I don't have that opportunity. And so my health care costs are sky high and I don't have the same quality of insurance. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Call here from Kyle in White Bear Lake. Hi, Kyle.
Hello.
Hi. What'd you want to tell us about?
I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but I just sort of think of it more broadly, like the insurance companies are just sort of profiting off of what I think is sort of a right. Like there's no companies making a profit off of me paying my water bill. So why are all these companies taking money out of my pocket that I should just be spending? You know, I'm okay spending money on healthcare, but I just really kind of view the insurance companies as this unnecessary middleman that doesn't need to be there.
Yeah. Hey, Kyle, just a quick question for you, though, because you sound younger than our last caller. Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 30.
Okay. So how much do you pay for health care per month? Do you know what your premiums are?
Yeah. So they're around like $900. And I just had some preventative care done.
Wow.
For like allergy shots for a bee allergy and then like a biopsy. And I had like a $2,000 bill for that. So it's kind of, I feel like I'm doing preventative care.
Yeah.
But I'm still having to pay a large amount for that. Like for me, that's like over a month of pay.
What do you hear in that, Senator? That's a lot of money, by the way.
Well, I think about somebody who is, the theory about healthcare is that younger people are healthier and are contributing into the pool, and older people are going to have more healthcare needs. But to have a younger person with that level of deductible and healthcare expense, it sounds to me like, it sounds to me like it's a healthcare plan that is not working very well. And it's just, it's insane to me that we would not be making it easier for people to get the preventative care that they need in order to avoid more healthcare costs and poorer health down the road.
Yeah. Senator Tina Smith with us in the studio here. She's leaving at about 10 to 10. So we're getting through a lot of questions here. We've started out on health care because a lot of Minnesotans and Americans feel that that's an issue top of mind. I'll open the phone lines now for more calls about other issues. I've got some questions for her, if we can get it in, about the cost of college, climate change. You're welcome to introduce some questions or ideas. And keep it going on healthcare if you like. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieNPR. I did want to ask you about this group that was running ads about out-of-network billing, although they weren't very transparent, the ads. I started seeing them this summer and thought, and I feel like I know a lot about healthcare policy, and I could not figure out what was going on in the ads. You were specifically one of the targets of this. Let's listen to the ad. I'll narrate a little bit because there's some silence in the middle and you're just seeing visuals. Here we go.
Memorial, do you copy? We've got a 16-year-old trauma victim going into shock.
Pulse fading. We gotta move.
Okay, this is the emergency first responders. They're walking into the hospital, and they're seeing that it's all dark.
Imagine if the care we needed wasn't there when we needed it most.
What's the story with this? And then you were, in Minnesota, you were tagged, call Senator Smith, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
What's the story with this?
Well, so when these ads first came up in the air, we're like, what are these ads about? Who are these people? It's sort of like that scene in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid where there's somebody chasing you and you go like, who are those guys? Nobody ever called me about this. So we looked into it and we tried to figure out what it was all about. And the ads were focused on this issue of surprise medical billing, which is a really big problem.
This is out of network billing?
Yes. Yeah, so let's say you fall and you need to take an ambulance to get to the hospital, and you go to an in-network hospital. You assume that you're doing everything right, and then you end up with a bill for an ambulance ride that was out of network, and you find out that the radiologist who looked at your x-rays was out of network, and you got a bill for several thousand dollars. And that's ridiculous. That should not be happening. I'm opposed to that. And in fact, I'm supporting and signed on to a bill that would solve that problem by saying that people, individuals shouldn't be stuck with those surprise medical bills. It should be worked out between the insurance companies and the providers.
Tell me how that specifically would work, though.
Yeah, well, what we would do is, let's say there's a bill that was presented that is out of network. This is a bipartisan bill that my colleagues Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire and Bill Cassidy from Louisiana have put together. And it says when there's that disagreement about how much the bill should be and it being out of network, we would use an arbitration process. It's actually quite similar to what we do in Minnesota already, but it would be for these plans that are regulated at the national level. But the key thing is that the consumers wouldn't be stuck with that bill, which it's not their fault that they got it. But so back to this ad and what's going on with the ad. So what we figured out, and the New York Times did some research on this and some investigation, they figured out that the ad was being paid for by two big private equity firms KKR and Blackstone, and those private equity firms own these provider companies, and they don't like the bill that is in Congress. But I'm actually even on the same side as they are on this, but they were still running these ads. And it wasn't just against Democrats, and it was also against Republicans.
Anybody who was signing on to support this bill. Okay, what's the status of the bill?
Well, so ever since, so there is a good proposal that would fix surprise medical billing that I am supporting. Ever since those ads started running in Minnesota and Maine, and I mean Michigan and Colorado and North Dakota, that bill is just sort of stalled out.
Because the ads were effective in some ways?
I believe that the ads were designed to intimidate. And I think that frankly, I think that Mitch McConnell in the United States Senate is kind of holding back on this because he doesn't want his incumbent members to get on the wrong side of that. And here's like the really weird thing. Okay. You may have noticed in the last couple of weeks that that same group has started to run ads. And now it's sort of saying, thanks, Senator Smith, for her position on this. So it's like
this a is position kind of, you didn't change.
This is a position that I didn't change. This is the kind of things that make people crazy.
I wondered if you've had a chance to read Dr. Marty McCary's new book on health care. He's a Johns Hopkins physician, does a lot of stuff on policy. It's called The Price We Pay.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is about what happens when these out-of-network bills come in and the patient can't pay it. There are many hospitals, including one in Texas, Maryland, all over the place, who then come after the patient with guns blazing, basically, to collect on. They go to court. There's a hospital in Texas that has taken like half the town to court. Is there any kind of, I mean, this sounds like it almost kind of dovetails with what you're talking about on
exactly.
this out-of-network billing.
Yep.
Is there any element of that legislation to deal with the way these hospitals come after people to be paid?
The legislation that I support, that I hope will move through the Senate and the House, would stop that kind of aggressive and, just terrible behavior, because it would say from the get-go that the individual who got that surprise medical bill through no fault of their own, mm-hmm. without knowing, they are not going to be on the hook for that. It's going to be up to that hospital, those providers, and the insurance company to duke it out and figure out who pays for it.
Okay. Call here from Lacey in Duluth. Hi, Lacey.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the maternity care question.
Sure.
To the senator, there's been some great reporting from NPR recently about adding or just about midwifery care, home birth midwifery care in Minnesota. And I'm curious if her bills and her work has thought about expanding midwifery care to rural Minnesota.
That's a really great question and issue. And it gets to something that I agree with very much, which is that we need to open up the way we provide health care so that there's not just one way of doing it. And especially if you have a pregnancy that is a low-risk pregnancy, and if there's more opportunities for more different kinds of providers to be able to help you and to be able to also get reimbursed, to me, that would be a really good thing. And I'm glad you raised that, because the bill that I'm working on, the bipartisan bill I'm working on for expanding maternity care, doesn't deal specifically yet with midwifery and other alternative providers. But I think that's something that we should definitely look at.
Senator, you've mentioned the fact that there are some Republicans who are signing on to some of this legislation that you're sponsoring and signing on to yourself. When you were campaigning, former Mayor R.T. Ryback, who you worked with for some time, said this of you: she's just kind of wired to find common ground. So I guess my question to you is, what is your evidence that DFL voters want common ground? I mean, many seem to despise what congressional Republicans stand for. Many do not like anything the president says or does. And in July, I was reading something that you wrote for CNN.com that said Mitch McConnell's leadership in the U.S. Senate has been a big fat waste. It sounds like you kind of disdain what Republican leadership is all about. So how do you end up being wired for common ground and yet express those kinds of views and take in the views of your constituents about it.
Yeah. Well, let me start first with what my experience is with Minnesota voters. You know, I travel, as you know, I go all over the state to the red counties and the blue counties and all of the counties in between. And I've never yet met a person, hardly, who wakes up in the morning and says, I'm a Democrat, I need to figure out how to take my kids to school, or I'm a Republican and my mom is in a nursing home and I need to figure out how to make sure she's getting the best care. People don't wake up in the morning thinking of their party identification first. They wake up thinking about their lives and what's working in their lives and what isn't working. And in my experience in this role, meeting people where they are in their lives is mostly not about politics. And that's where the common ground can be found. And that's where people who are kind of fed up with politics are happy to hear somebody talk to them about how they're reaching across the party, you know, party divides like I do, to try to find places where you can find agreement. And that's what I'm doing on energy bills and on workforce bills and on healthcare bills.
You know, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, because I want to get to your question about Mitch McConnell. Now, Mitch McConnell has essentially turned the United States Senate into a body that approves the judicial nominations and the appointments of agencies. That is almost exclusively the legislative work that we do. This is very frustrating to me because I think that the Senate should be more than that. And that's what I mean when I say that he's turned the Senate into a big fat waste. But some of my Republican colleagues would not say that publicly because he's their leader, but they feel the same way. Think about what we just talked about a minute ago, about a solution to surprise medical bills that would help Americans in Republican states and Democratic states. We ought to be voting and moving on those bills. And yet under McConnell's leadership, we're not. So I'm trying not to be partisan about it, but it's just the fact that that's how he's leading the Senate. And if we get control, it's going to be on us to not do the same thing.
You know, I don't think I agree people don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm a Democrat and that's how I'm living my day today.
Right.
But they do make decisions on the kind of media that they're going to access and the opinions that they're going to believe and some of the choices about where they're going to live. We know that, right? The way people are sorting themselves ends up being political. And when they have a choice to vote for somebody who is perhaps more moderate or at the edges of party identity, many, many Americans decide to vote for the person that's at the edges, the extremist in the party. So this idea of I'm just wired for common ground really sounds good. But then when you look at the behavior of voters and Americans, it doesn't seem to fit with where we are today.
Well, I think it actually does fit. But the reality is that you don't see it when you're looking at the media. You know, if you watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, you would think that all we do in Washington is sit around and yell at each other, talk about impeachment and, you know, the Mueller report. That's actually not
and
the
you
way.
Don't? Okay.
No, that's actually not the way it is. That's not the way it is at all. And so, you know, I think part of the issue is, and I mean, I hate to sort of blatantly pander to Minnesota Public Radio, but part of the issue is that
cable. Oh, go right ahead. No.
I was saying earlier that I'm probably one of the listeners that actually did listen all the way through last week during a pledge drive. But my point is that cable news covers politics and governing like sports and entertainment. That's the root of cable news. It came out of entertainment and sports. And so I really do believe that it gives a distorted idea of where most Americans are. And all I can do is report on the conversations that I have. You know, in Western Minnesota last week, not a single person asked me about impeachment. Not a single person asked me why was I willing to compromise? What's wrong with you? I'm being willing to compromise. Everybody wants to say, is there any hope? Is there a chance that we can work together? Is there a chance that we can find some common ground? That's what people want.
I do want to ask you about impeachment, of course.
Of course.
But I knew there were a lot of questions here on healthcare and some of the other issues. Mm-hmm. Are you a yes on President Trump's impeachment being removed if the Senate ends up holding a trial? Have you made a decision on that with what you've seen so far?
I haven't made a decision. And in fact, I think that it is my constitutional responsibility to be open to all of the facts if that comes forward. I did say that I thought that it was important that the House begin impeachment proceedings. what we have seen over the last 2 weeks about the conversation that the president had with the president of Ukraine, appearing to ask a favor of his getting involved in our electoral process in exchange for, or even, you know, even if it's not in exchange for, just asking for his interference, to me is a threat to our national security. And the president admitted that he did that. So to me, beginning that impeachment proceeding is the right thing to do. When and if it comes to the United States Senate, my job is to be jury in that proceeding, and I will look at all of the facts and then make that decision.
Question about 2020 politics here. Why do you think Senator Amy Klobuchar's campaign hasn't really caught on?
Well, there is so much about this campaign right now that is still driven by name ID and who's the most famous. And I think that that has been a challenge for Amy.
I mean, Mayor Buttigieg, nobody knew him and his name
true.
Is hard to pronounce.
Yeah.
And he did something on the trail, right, that she hasn't.
That is true. That is true. Mayor Pete has definitely captured people's imaginations. And I think if Amy were here, she's saying, you know, this is hard work. I'm waiting for that moment. It's hard to say. No votes have been counted yet. I have no idea what's going to happen on the presidential side with the Democrats.
But you were a longtime political staffer and strategist. As you look at her campaign, what do you think has gone wrong? Is it more about how she's trying to stay so carefully in the middle? And this goes back to what we talked about a few minutes ago. Or is she just doing something else that isn't working?
Well, I think I will. I've sort of hung up my my campaign advisory spurs 18 months or so ago. So I'm not going to give her political advice. But I will say that I was down in Iowa with her a couple of weeks ago for the Polk County steak fry. And I just, you know, no votes have been counted yet anywhere. And we'll see what happens. And, you know, it's hard to become president.
Call here from Nancy in Minneapolis. Hi, Nancy. On healthcare, right?
Yes, I'm still on health care.
Okay, that's good.
Back
all
that
good.
Direction.
Minnesota is
but,
still on health care.
One of the things I hear in all the discussions that you guys have been talking to, and, you know, nice to talk directly to you, Senator Smith.
Thank you.
Is I hear two topics. I hear quality health care, which is so important. But I also feel like quality health care gets kind of the upper hand versus health care for all. And I have a 33-year-old daughter who's almost never had health care in her adult life and still does not have health care. And she can't get health care unless she's not working and gets Minnesota care, which she has had that. And that's wonderful. I love when she's not working and gets Minnesota care because I'd rather have her have health care than a job almost at some point. But right now she's 33 working a minimum wage job. If she takes the health care that her employer offers, it's 2/3 of her paycheck.
Wow.
And she can't afford that. So she denies that. And she needs mental health care. Mm-hmm. And so I am paying for her to go to see her therapist because she has no health care. And it's critical that she gets that care. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect is I'm also a mental health provider.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgive people's deductibles all the time, which is just off the bottom line of my income because they can't afford them. And I cannot turn them away in the middle of treatment because they need the treatment.
Right.
And so I forgive their deductible, which comes out of the bottom line of my dollars.
Right.
So,
but you acknowledge that they need the treatment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They need the treatment. And as a mental health provider, I'm not going to turn them away. I'm going to forgive their deductible so they can keep coming. And I will get paid something from the insurance companies.
Right.
But not what I normally would get paid.
Nancy, if I might, we're just in our last minutes here of when Senator Smith has to leave. So I just wanted to reflect on what you've said.
Well, I really am so grateful that you raised this because access to mental health care is one of the great problems that we have in this country. And it is an issue in rural areas and urban areas. And this is personal to me because, you know, the seat that I sit in has been the seat of Paul Wellstone and Al Franken. We have in this position all worked to get parity for mental health coverage, just like you have coverage for other health care. And we still have not achieved that in this country. And that is one of the reasons that we end up with the situation that Nancy and her daughter are in. We have got to get true mental health coverage parity. And Nancy, I want to just follow up on the other thing that you said before we stop here, which is that I agree with you that healthcare should be a fundamental human right. It should not be something that you can only afford if you can afford it. And that is why, you know, why I believe so strongly that we need to expand access to healthcare coverage for everyone. It should not be something that you only have because you can afford it.
Senator, in September, you signed on to a Senate bill that would allow banks to work with cannabis companies,
yes,
right, without fear of federal regulation. I wonder if, in a larger sense, you think it's time for Minnesota to legalize recreational marijuana.
Well, I think that it is definitely time for us to look at this. I haven't taken a position yet on all of the various bills that are out there around legalization versus decriminalization.
Can I ask why not? I mean, you've held this position for 18 months. This has been happening in other states around the country. Why haven't you figured out what you think about it?
Well, because I think there are some really important issues that I still want to make sure we get right. Here's an example. There are many reasons to think that we should move forward with legalization of cannabis, yet we just were talking about mental health issues. The mental health community has come out strongly opposed because they understand that there is a linkage between heavy use of cannabis when you're young and serious mental health challenges. And so I want to make sure that we get that right. I also understand that there are issues still I want to get to the bottom of around being able to understand what impact driving under the influence has and how we can make sure that, you know, our roads stay safe. So I don't think that I'm glad that I'm taking some time to figure this out and make sure that I do the right thing.
Let me grab one last call for you to Katie in Minneapolis. Hi, Katie. I really appreciate you waiting. Didn't want to miss you.
Oh, thank you. Well, my comment was that we, you know, have our health care. We have dental, vision. We have RX insurance. Mm-hmm. So we're paying for all of these. And the deductibles are so high, like Julie said, that you really don't use them. So then you have to create an HSA account, and you're putting enough in to cover the deductibles. But all of them, so you have, you know, five different health insurance cards and HSA card, and all of them dictate how you can use the money that you're putting in. But then there are items that are legitimate health care, you know, especially with women's health care, mm-hmm, that don't fall under the categories. So then you're paying for those on top of that, even outside of your HSA.
Katie, do you know about what you pay month to month for health care?
I pay $170 per paycheck just in health care alone. And then I put in $160 per paycheck just for HSA.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's not even including dental, mm-hmm, that doesn't cover orthodontics.
Right. The co-pays and the deductibles, right. Katie, if I might,
yeah,
we've only got a couple minutes left for the senator, and I wanted you to have a chance to say something about that.
Well, this is exactly another example about how healthcare costs has become the driving economic issue for so many people, so many Minnesotans, so many families. And it's why I'm working in the Senate to get a handle on what we can do to drive down the cost of health care and make sure that the insurance that people have is actually good insurance and not junk insurance.
Senator, a last question here. You said earlier, well, if you watch cable news, it looks like all we're doing is impeachment. What's your top priority now that you come back from this 2-week break? And what do you think can actually get done in the next few weeks before you go on your next break?
Yeah. Well, my top priority will be to go and continue to push on healthcare costs and especially prescription drug costs, which has been my primary goal ever since I got to the Senate. And, you know, I'm an optimist. I will continue to push on this, even though I know that it's going to be a challenge. The Senate is going to be, I hope, moving forward with the big budget bills that we need to get passed by the end of the year. And we have a deadline of right before Thanksgiving to get those bills that will fund the federal government between, mm-hmm, now and, the end of next year. Included in those bills are really important provisions to support rural hospitals and to support community behavioral health clinics and other ways in which people can get access to health care. And so I'm going to be really focused to make sure that those bills get passed.
Really good to have you here. Thank you for taking so many questions from me and from the listeners.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time.
Great.
Thank you.
just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.